From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Old Patrick Ewing's happy, and he's not the only one. The folks who call Ohio home are having lots of fun. The Gators out of Florida are back to bite again. And UCLA is reminding us of way back when John Wooden coached the winner every year and called for more. We've reached the weekend when it's time to watch the Final Four. Joining me now on the line from Atlanta to discuss the 2007 Men's Final Four is ESPN's Pat Forte. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Bill. I'm inspired by your verse.
Well, you're one of the very few people, I'm sure. But in any case, this evening, Georgetown will play Ohio State for the right to advance to the finals. Most of the talk seems to center around those teams' big men. Are we about to witness a contest of the colossi for the ages?
I think it's very possible. You know, we're looking at two guys that will probably play 10 or 15 years in the NBA eventually, Greg Oden and Roy Hibbert. We've gone many, many years without seeing these guys dominate in college before. And now they're back in spades here playing against each other, both very skilled, very aggressive, great defensive players, so they may limit each other. And really, you know, in that sort of situation, I could see a guy like Jeff Green, who's only 6'9", for Georgetown, ending up being the big man on the court.
Well, Oden's ability or inability to stay out of foul trouble generally seems to determine how effective Ohio State can be. Will he be able to stay out of foul trouble against Hibbert?
Great question, because that's, you know, he is a very aggressive shot blocker. He reaches in on guys going for the ball, so, you know, he's really going to have to play smart, I would say. And, you know, it might be an advantage to playing somebody's own size where he's not swatting down at them and at the ball, so he might be able to keep his hands out of harm's way to a degree.
Some observers are saying that despite their status as a number two seed, the Hoyas are lucky to be in the Final Four. What do you think?
No luckier than Ohio State, which I saw in person, needed a three-pointer with 2 seconds left to tie Xavier and go into overtime in the second round. So, you know, I think both teams have had their near misses in this tournament. Obviously, the Georgetown one with Vanderbilt, but most teams end up having a game like that somewhere along the way to a Final Four, and I wouldn't call it luck for either side.
Later tonight, Florida takes on UCLA in a rematch of the 2006 final. UCLA has got the defense. Florida has the depth. Do you agree that this game is intriguing for those reasons, and maybe there are more reasons, too?
Oh, yes. I think there are many reasons. Certainly those two that you mentioned, but also the fact that they played a year ago in the title game and Florida absolutely routed UCLA. I think being the underdog almost sets a team free, and I could see UCLA being able to play with a great deal less pressure on them. Obviously, I think that this will be a closer game than that. It's very reminiscent, actually, of 1990 and 91 when Duke was crushed by UNLV in the final and then came back and upset them in the semifinals the next year in a great game. I don't see UCLA winning, but I do see a close game.
Does the world really hate Florida as their star Joakim Noah claims, or is this just standard locker room motivational trash talking?
Yeah, that's all it is. It's boilerplate us against the world stuff, which, you know, these days that seems to go a long way for guys. They nobody wants the respect. They all just complain about not getting it. But I don't see them as being anywhere near as unloved as, say, Duke is by some people. You know, the fact is, last year they were a fresh story, and this year they're not so fresh, and so there's probably some people that are tired of them winning, but I don't see them as hated, no.
There have been basketball celebrity sightings throughout this tournament. No surprise, this is a big draw. But John Thompson, John Wooden, Danny Ainge, Bill Walton, Adolph Rupp, Yoda, the ghost of Obi-Wan Kenobi, I think, was spotted last week. Who's next?
Great question. This being Atlanta, you know, maybe we'll have Hammer and Hank Aaron in the stands or something. You know, there are an amazing number of players here or coaches here who have famous relatives, fathers, and mothers, that sort of thing, that the bloodlines are awfully strong in this tournament.
You know, Pat, everybody, for entertainment purposes only, of course, gets involved in the brackets for these tournaments. And we at Only a Game are supposed to be experts, and our brackets are all in utter shambles. You know, I think somebody who doesn't know a basketball from a, you know, cassava melon is winning the pool at this point. What about yourself? Did you have some brackets? And if so, what sort of shape are they in?
I'm so glad you asked, because you've just invited me to brag for once. I have all four of the Final Four.
Oh, my goodness.
I had seven of the Final Eight, and if AC Law of Texas A&M could make a layup, I would have had eight of the Final Eight, because they would have beaten Memphis. So not that I'm bitter. But, no, and this is, you know, I lose to the people, the cassava melon people, every year. So this is my 1 year of revenge. I think it's like the first time in 17 years I'm actually leading the pool I'm in.
Given what you've accomplished, you are obviously the right man to ask the last question of our conversation. Who wins the semifinal games and who wins the whole thing?
Yeah, well, I better stick with what's got me here. So I'll take Florida over UCLA. I'll take Georgetown over Ohio State, and then Florida over the Hoyas on Monday night.
Pat Forte is a columnist for ESPN.com, and he talks college hoops from time to time here on Only a Game as well. Thanks again, Pat.
My pleasure.
The women's semifinals begin tomorrow in Cleveland, where number one seed North Carolina and Tennessee will battle, following a tilt between number three LSU and number four Rutgers. Joining me now on the line from Cleveland is Michelle Smith, who covers women's college basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, let's start with LSU, which made headlines a couple of weeks ago after head coach Pokey Chatman resigned amid allegations that she had had an inappropriate relationship with a former player. Now the story is the Tigers' strong play and a fourth consecutive trip to the Final Four, right?
Yeah, they've really, you know, I think that they've gained a lot of motivation maybe from their bad circumstances, and they have played really, really well.
Interim head coach Bob Starkey has helped LSU continue to play very well, despite the fact that his style is very different, not only from Chatman's, but from virtually every coach I've seen on the sidelines in either tournament.
Yes, the play everybody theory. Yeah, he is. It's very different, but I'm not sure in this case, in this short tournament time, that it's going to matter, which is not to take anything away from Bob Starkey holding that program together. But I think that at this point, when you're this deep in the season, these kids know what it is that they've been taught to do all year, and I think that they're riding a lot of emotion, and the fact that they've got one of the best players in the country in Sylvia Fowles. I think it's, you know, not really what Bob has or hasn't done at this point, but it's how he's held this all together.
Well, it is, of course, the play everybody theory, as you say, but also he's so quiet. His neck veins don't bulge. He doesn't run up and down the court screaming and shouting and incurring technical fouls.
No, he's very low-key. You know, there are some coaches who can pull that off, and apparently Bob is one of those guys. I mean, there are, you know, there are the coaches who, you know, are down on one knee pounding on the floor and screaming, and, you know, I think it's just a stylistic difference. Pokey was very energetic and very, you know, fiery on the sidelines, and he's sort of the antithesis of that. But again, I think it's been holding that group together, and maybe that demeanor goes a long way to keeping those kids calm. Maybe, you know, everything's all right. We're doing what we've been taught to do, and if he looks calm, then everybody else is good too.
LSU's opponent will be Rutgers. Rutgers head coach C. Vivian Stringer is the only coach to have brought three different programs to the Final Four, those teams being Cheney University back in 1982, Iowa in 93, and Rutgers in 2000. I have the feeling that what she'd really like on her resume is a championship.
Yeah, I think that title would be, yeah, that would be the crowning achievement for her. She's a great coach, and they are a very good team. And this is a team that was in and out of, at the beginning of the year, they lost to Pepperdine over in Southern California, a team that didn't finish with anything close to a winning record. They really struggled, and they have come around very nicely, and they're really talented. I mean, T. Ajavon and Essence Carson, and this is a good team. And with the way they play defense, and I think this could be a title year for Rutgers if they can get through the Tennessee juggernaut, because they think the Lady Vols are just playing out of their minds right now.
Coach Stringer had a great response to the fact that her team wasn't playing as well as she thought it should earlier in the season. She took away their sweatsuits.
Well, that, and she also brought in a bunch of their former players, star players, to come in and actually scrimmage against them and play against them and hope to sort of show them what level of play they needed to get to. They were both interesting tactics.
In the later game tomorrow, UNC takes on Tennessee. It's really not fair that the number one seeded juggernauts have to play each other just to get to the finals, is it?
No, but that's the way it worked out. I mean, you know, Tennessee survived that Dayton region, which was the stacked region that everybody looked at, and then it crumbled a bit when Mississippi kind of laid waste to Maryland and then Oklahoma and, you know, and then didn't play well against Tennessee and I think would be disappointed in that performance. But, yeah, the two number ones, because on the other side, the seeds didn't hold up in the bracket.
You could excuse Tennessee head coach Pat Summitt for having a ho-hum attitude about a possible seventh title, which is, of course, what this one would be. But she doesn't appear to be jaded, does she?
No, I don't think it's jaded. I think it's just keeping things a little low-key. You've got teams that talk about wanting to do something special, or they talk about openly about their Final Four goals or their title aspirations. And when they don't happen, I think there's pressure, that self-imposed pressure, and I also think that disappointment becomes more acute. Tennessee has not won a title in a long time, but I think Pat's approach is, we're not going to go there. We're not going to spend a bunch of time talking about the title we want that we don't get. We're just going to do what we need to do to get ourselves back there, and that's what they've done.
North Carolina beat Tennessee back in December and then went undefeated for most of the rest of the regular season. What has changed for both teams since that game?
Well, at the time that North Carolina beat Tennessee, they hadn't really gone through the meat of the rigors of that ACC schedule yet, which was just, you know, between Maryland and Duke and North Carolina, is just a bruising battle in that conference. And I think Tennessee is just playing at a different level. I think Candace Parker is playing at a different level. She is, you know, Lindsey Harding may come away with some of the Player of the Year awards for her performances in those big games during the regular season, but Candace Parker is the best player in this land, and she's really playing like it in the tournament. So I think Candace elevating her game is maybe the biggest difference.
Okay, Michelle, enough with the preface portion of this conversation. It's time now for you to entertain us by predicting the final two and then, please, the final one.
Rutgers and Tennessee wins it all.
Oh, nuts. I was kind of hoping for Rutgers. I like to see Vivian Stringer finally win one.
I do, absolutely, but I think Pat's been denied a long time, and, you know, if you just watch them play, this looks like a team that's, you know, not going to be done until they're done, and that'll be when they're holding the trophy up.
Michelle Smith covers women's hoops for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks, Michelle, and have a good offseason.
Thank you. You too.
Should an established baseball writer desire work in another arena, like hockey, for instance, a trail has been blazed. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor reports.
Let's play make-believe. Pretend you're a general manager of an NHL team like, I don't know, the Minnesota Wild, and you need a new head of hockey operations. You could hire an old-timey hockey guy, you know, the kind that grew up mucking it up on frozen ponds outside of Moose Jaw or Saskatoon ever since he was a mite or a squirt. Or you can hire a beat writer from the Boston Globe, and not just any beat writer, a 24-year-old who covers baseball. Who would you pick? If you're Minnesota Wild general manager Doug Ricebrow, you'd pick Chris Snow. The Wild made that unusual move last June, but everyone in the organization thinks Chris Snow is a fine young man. Just ask Wild assistant GM Tom Lynn.
He's done a very good job. He gets up in the morning, he thinks about his job, and he goes to bed at night, he's thinking about how to make it better the next day, and I think he's been exactly as we expected, and probably even a little more so.
That still doesn't explain how Chris Snow got the job. Perhaps his former co-worker at the Globe and hockey reporter Kevin Paul DuPont could shed some light.
I think what happened was Doug Ricebrow is a sharp guy, former Montreal Canadian, who is the general manager of Minnesota. I think was just, as we all have been with Chris, impressed with his intelligence, how he carries himself, bright with a degree of humility. Probably what's less important about Chris is where he came from in terms of job, and what's most important is that he's a very engaging man and he's a very bright guy.
But hard work, intelligence, amiability, and the occasional rescue of orphan puppies from burning buildings is usually not enough to become an NHL executive. Perhaps Snow can explain best why Ricebrow and the Wild thought he was the man for the job.
I think it was another set of eyes. You know, the question then is, why my set versus somebody who's more experienced around hockey? I think he viewed my inexperience and my lack of institutional knowledge about how a hockey team is run as a plus, because he figured I could ask questions not knowing how things traditionally are done and maybe raise some good points.
Chris Snow watches his team's morning skate at Boston's TD Bank North Garden before an early March game between the Wild and the Boston Bruins. His journey to this point began at the old Boston Garden, which stood only a few hundred yards from where he's sitting. He grew up in a suburb 10 miles away and rooted for the Bruins. It's probably safe to say it's a surreal moment for a guy who at this time last year was in Fort Myers, Florida, covering Red Sox spring training.
If you had to pick the four teams in Boston, which one I grew up following the most and rooting for, it would have been the Bruins. And I was excited to come, and I came in the building and was a little nervous. It's very different. It's exciting, but so much is out of my control. You know, as a writer, you know, you're at home and you write your story and you can stand behind what you did. And tonight, the team speaks for everything. So I'm hoping the guys play well.
Snow's newspaper career began as an intern for the Boston Globe. He spent the summer of 2001 and 2002 working with Kevin Paul DuPont in the Globe sports department. After he graduated from Syracuse University, he got his first paying job covering the Wild for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. There he got to know Rice Brow and Lynn and formed a relationship that remained strong even when Snow returned to the Globe to cover the Red Sox in 2005. The Sox had just wrapped up a world championship thanks in part to Theo Epstein, who in 2002 was made the youngest GM in Major League history at age 28. Did that spark something in Snow?
I think that over the past couple of years, especially when I left Minnesota to come back to Boston, it was in the back of my head, and very much in the back. It wasn't something that I said in a year or two or 3 years, I want to make a jump like this. It was just a curiosity to me when it first was brought up in a casual conversation with Doug Risebrough a couple of years ago. And, you know, I took a peek, and hopefully it's a good decision.
Lynn feels Snow has already been a boon to the Wild in at least one way.
He's of the technology generation, and he can, when we're considering a player, you know, he's pulling stuff out of technology now, not only statistical, but video and information on a player that we wouldn't have been able to do or even think of. And so he's kind of that next generation that's going to add more information.
That's certainly a new approach for a league that doesn't always embrace the new. DuPont says money is one thing that has forced front offices to rethink how they do business.
Traditionally, hockey has always looked from within. Typically, it hires ex-players and moves ex-players along. Players in the NHL for the last 17 to 20 years now have made very good money. This isn't like the old days when a guy, say, made $75,000 a year for a few years as a spare defenseman, and then moved into minor league coaching or scouting. I think it's harder today to get players to think about coming into front offices when the average pay is around $1.6 million, $1.8 million.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with super handling all-wheel drive. More at acura.com/RDX.